Today we get on board a trawler in West Cornwall to understand why almost the entire fishing industry voted for Brexit. And in opinion, The Guardian's Nesrin Malik hits back at Hillary Clinton. Why did you want to go fishing?
I've always been interested in fishing. I've always liked going to fishmongers.
You've always liked going to fishmongers?
I love fishmongers. But also because of fishing being such a sort of ongoing story in Brexit. Played a big part in the referendum, if you remember Nigel Farage coming up the Thames on his trawler. And
how could I forget?
Chucking haddock at Bob Geldof.
Nigel, you're a fraud. Here are the facts about fishing.
It was a bizarre spectacle. In the middle of the Thames, just days before the EU referendum vote in June 2016.
You are no fisherman's friend.
Bob Geldof was on a large white pleasure boat. Nigel Farage, then leader of UKIP, was leading a fleet of smaller boats. And they were shouting at each other about fishing rights.
What Mr. Geldof, multimillionaire Mr. Geldof, did was show his absolute contempt for the men and women that have come here today asking, demanding to be listened to.
The fishing industry sided with Farage. It's thought that 92% voted to leave. And the question of fishing rights has remained a flashpoint in negotiations ever since.
It seems to kind of encapsulate what people think about Europe as being a sort of interfering state. 58% of fish caught in British waters is caught by boats from other EU countries.
Theresa May says she's got agreement that the UK will be an independent coastal state after Brexit. But the final deal on fisheries can only be completed after the UK leaves the EU. This is an industry that feels like it's been betrayed before.
Fishermen are very worried that they will be betrayed again.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, one boat's ongoing fight to really take back control.
So we got to the boat early in the morning, clambered aboard.
Sam Wollaston is a Guardian features writer who has just spent 4 days aboard Crystal Sea, a large fishing trawler based in Newlyn, West Cornwall.
No, I've got grease here. I'm going to end up losing.
There was no one else, no other fishing boats going out because it was quite rough. So
And you know when you're sort of pulling yourself up the iron ladder onto the boat, it's dark, you're at the port.
Yeah.
I'd be thinking, I'm going to feel sick in about 5 minutes and then I'm not going to be able to get off for 6 days.
Well, I wasn't thinking that. And then 5 minutes later, I was feeling sick.
5 minutes later?
Yeah, because as soon as you get out of the harbour entrance, we hit these big waves. And these big waves were with us for the whole time we were out. So 5 metre waves.
That's very big. A lot bigger than us, yeah?
It's bigger
five
than
meters.
Us, yeah.
And that's scary.
Yeah, and there's all this equipment, some of it kind of high up equipment, cranes and blocks and things and chains and stuff. That was one of the things that I took away from is the kind of pure physicality of it. They're pulling big ropes and big chains and heavy weights and stuff, all while the boat is kind of like heaving up and down, and they're doing it 24 hours a day. So it's kind of, it was complete eye-opener.
And tell us who's on board.
So the skipper is David Stevens, Dave. He has been fishing since he was 15, and he's 44 now, and fishing has been in his family for he knows, he can name five generations back, but he thinks it goes much further back than that. He's a family fisherman.
Well, in Cornwall, fishing is a big part of what we do. It's part of the Cornish emblem, fishing and mining. Well, the mining's, you know, is all but gone. So fishing is what we have left of our heritage.
So he's big, and they're all big, actually. I mean, that's something I noticed about fishermen. They're all enormous. He's like a big bear. He's very calm, though. He doesn't shout. He's generally in the wheelhouse, issuing instructions out of the window to his crew.
Robert, can you stop up here when I slap...
And who is he not shouting at?
So he's not shouting at his crew, and his crew are...
Gert.
Gert.
Golf India Romeo Tango Sierra.
And Gert, where are you from?
Latvia.
And Robert and Edgar.
Robert, how long have you been here fishing in Cornwall?
About 8 years.
Yeah. Also, I mean, you're here and your family is not here, are they?
Yeah, he's at Latvia. Two boys, yeah.
And how old are they?
12 and 6 years.
Edgar and Robert are also big. Everyone's big, as I mentioned. And they're 32 and they are identical twins. And Edgar has tattoos, whereas Robert doesn't have tattoos, so that's the way I could tell them apart. When they're on deck in their sort of yellow gear, I basically had no idea who was who.
Tell us what the crew do.
So they drive along for 5 hours in a straight line, trying to catch fish. Gertz is kind of operating the winch to lower that down, and Edgar or Robert, because I don't know at this stage, is underneath. And the fish kind of spill into this hold area called the hopper. Suddenly there's a kind of big mound of flapping, sort of dying fish.
There's a few plaice in there. There's a few small haddock. But there's a lot of gurnard there, so Dave's not happy about that.
It's a sort of extraordinary sight, actually, all these kind of, fish dead or dying, lots of gasping, wriggling around. I saw a kind of crab trying to make a break for it.
Crayfish is trying to escape.
I mean, it does make you think about eating fish, definitely.
That's not what David wanted you to take away.
No, but actually, I mean, he did want me to see the reality of it. And I think, I think everyone should know what happens. So, yeah, the fish are coming along this conveyor belt and they're sorting them and gutting them and sorting them into different species. And then some of them go down a chute into the sea. Some of them get discarded. He was concerned about me seeing that because it's a terrible thing to see a perfectly good fish being chucked away over the side.
But what's the point in throwing away a dead fish?
There's no point at all. There's no point in throwing away a dead fish.
But why do we have to do it then?
Because he's not allowed to land it.
So you've talked about this discarding of fish. Just tell us how that relates to being a member of the EU.
So they set the quotas. So the EU sets the quotas for different nations and what they can catch of different species. The problem with Dave is that they catch lots of different species. So in his net, he's got haddocks and cod and whatever else. He's got a certain quota for each species. And when he reaches a quota of, say, haddock, he has to stop taking more of them home. So he's not allowed to take any more of those to the market. So he chucks them over the side. The quotas are set by scientists, and to get quotas through takes a while. And Dave says that the science can be kind of up to 5 years old. And what he experiences on the ground is completely different from what they have found out. So with haddock, he finds that he's catching loads and loads of haddock, but they say that there aren't these haddock around. So that's why he's chucking them away.
Sounds like this was annoying, Dave.
No fisherman likes to chuck a perfectly good fish over the side. And actually, it's going to get more difficult because there's going to be a new rule where discarding is disallowed. But that means that when Dave reaches his quota of a certain fish, then he has to stop fishing, basically. So he'll reach that with haddock and then he'll just have to stop. I mean, this is another massive worry for him. It's another example of why he thinks that petty rules from Europe are stopping him and his livelihood.
So there was a poll at the time of the referendum suggesting that 92% of the industry voted out.
The 8%, Dave has no idea who they could possibly be, because, I mean, he thinks they might have business interest in Europe or something like that. But it was the most, it's the most Brexit industry in the UK.
And why was that?
So as a member of the EU, we're tied to what's called the Common Fisheries Policy. Basically, fish are seen as a kind of shared commodity. So countries don't have control over their own waters. They are shared out between nations. I think the whole kind of debate and what's seen wrong with the EU is kind of encapsulated by the fishing industry. You've got this island of people who've always been fishing in off their waters. And there's a slight kind of, get off my land kind of element to it. But you can kind of totally understand it, really. Basically, talking to anyone on the boat was quite difficult because there was a lot of noise around. But I did manage to kind of get Dave on his watch, sitting in the wheelhouse, where it's a little bit quieter, to talk about all this stuff.
What's a wheelhouse?
it's like the cockpit of an aeroplane. So there's a kind of, it's the bit where you drive. So he's in there.
UK is the place to come and fish. I mean, without a doubt. So we've basically been pushed aside to allow the EU, other EU fleets to come in and fish. And to give you some example, where the distance we've travelled is, in before 1973, before we joined, we used to take 85% of the fishing in our own waters, the UK did, and now that's down to 36%. So we're getting a very poor deal. We're getting less than half of the fish in our own waters.
He's very worried. I mean, he thinks his industry will be traded away in exchange for something that's a more profitable sector. They've been concerned about this since 1973, when Edward Heath took Britain into the common market, when the fishing industry was kind of reassured that they would maintain some control over their waters, and they weren't. Dave and other fishermen are very worried that they will be betrayed again, as they were then.
And did Dave specifically tell you why he voted to leave?
Yes.
In actual fact, when I did approach the choice, I thought, well, I'm not going to vote just on fishing. I'm going to really take this as a whole, because if I just voted on fishing, I would have just voted out.
And actually, he went to Brussels once.
What, to campaign?
No, he was going there to present a roundtable discussion about some filter that stopped them catching fish that were too small. Basically, it was a net with bigger holes so the little ones could escape.
Because otherwise they might die and you have to send them back.
Well, yeah, I mean, it wasn't for sentimental reasons entirely. It was about maintaining fish stocks.
Yeah, so Dave's quite political.
He's gone to present an idea about that. He had some kind of views on the whole setup when he got there.
It made my mind up straight away, seeing how the place functioned, really.
What was it about the way the place functioned that you didn't like the look of?
Well, it's incredibly well oiled. You know, you go there and there's many different languages you've spoken. You go to a round table meeting and, you know, the infrastructure and the way it's set up is fascinating. It really is. And I was quite impressed with that. But you come out of the meeting, and I went down to meet my local MEP. The floor started to slowly fill up, and thousands of people on this floor. So I said to my local MEP, who are all these people? They can't be just MEPs. She said, oh no, majority of the people on this floor would be lobbyists working for NGOs or big chemical companies of the like, and that's part of their role. They live and work here and work alongside us. So I was kind of taken aback by this. I mean, I'm not naive. I know that lobbying goes on, but it was an enormous scale. So yeah, there must have been four or five lobbyists to every MEP. So I said to Julie at the time, I said, well, how often do you meet a constituent? I mean, it's quite rare, you know, constituents don't get to come here. And I said to her, that's it, I'm out, because there's too much company power.
He's actually gone to Brussels and he's seen the scale of lobbying, and that's put him off.
Yeah, it was going there to Brussels, which was the final straw for him.
Did they accept what he pitched? Was he annoyed about that?
He was annoyed about that, yeah.
I can see his frustrations.
And also, it's not just about the fishing industry itself. It's also about, he talks a lot about coastal communities, because he's, you know, he's part of a coastal community. And it's, although there are only 12,000 fishermen in Britain, he says that the number of people that are affected by fishing is much, much bigger than that. The coastal community is very tied in with fishing, and they have a kind of attachment to the sea, which goes back a long way. And they think there are rights connected to the sea that they have, completely understandably.
For all of this, and it's been quite persuasive on why people like Dave, and 92% of the fishing industry have voted to leave, there's one point in your story that just keeps coming back in my head, and that's the three Latvians on board. So, you know, people like Dave have really benefited from European migration. Did that persuade him in a different way? Is he worried about what might happen?
Yeah, well, I mean, to me it looked like a massive irony hanging over the whole boat that you've got these three Latvians on board. I mean, their situation is quite interesting. All of them, they all work 2 months on, 1 month off. So, and then their families don't live here. They all live back in Latvia. Gertz told me that if it was a no-deal Brexit, he was worried about whether he would be able to continue working. The other two kind of, you know, weren't sure. None of them are here forever. They all want to make money and go back.
Why doesn't Dave hire people from the UK?
He doesn't hire people from the UK because people in the UK don't want to do it. I mean, fishing has a reputation for being hard and dangerous. he recognises it's a problem. He thinks that there's never going to be a situation where he's not going to be able to hire people from abroad if it comes down to it. He wants to be able to choose the best people, whether they're from Latvia or Penzance. He's not anti-immigration at all. I mean, without his Latvian workers, he couldn't run his boat, basically.
So why has fishing become such a critical part of the Brexit negotiation?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that simply the fishing in this country is actually, we have some of the best fishing waters in Europe, and a lot of EU countries are now worried about what will happen if we do take control back of our waters. Going back to the stats, I mean, it shows that a lot more of them come to Britain to fish than we go to them to fish. It's a tiny industry, but it punches above its weight in terms of its kind of influence. Because we're an island nation and our fisheries are seen to be kind of part of who we are, so it's become sort of emblematic of the whole process. And they look at other countries with really good fishing, like Greenland, Norway, Iceland. They now control their own waters and they allow other countries to fish in their waters under a kind of license system. And that's what Dave and other people in the fishing industry would like to see here.
How important is it that Theresa May gets fishing right in these negotiations?
Well, I mean, that's difficult. I mean, in the terms of the economy, you would say not massively important. It's tiny. I mean, it employs 12,000 people. In another way, in terms of kind of how it's seen, how it's perceived, what it represents to various communities, to the whole country as a sort of island nation that fishes its own fish out of its own waters, it has a much bigger kind of influence than its economy suggests.
Just finally, Sam, so you're shaky-legged, it's been 4 days, you're climbing down your ladder. How do you feel? Just take us off the boat.
I feel a bit smelly. I definitely need a shower. Even though there was one, I didn't brave the shower because it was too rough. I came away with a complete understanding of why that industry had voted the way it did in the referendum. And probably more than that, I came away with a kind of, you know, enormous amount of admiration for the people who do that. I mean, it's a really, really tough, relentless job.
Are you worried about their future?
They are. And so because of that, I am.
You can read Sam's piece about his time out at sea at theguardian.com. And you can follow Dave and his crew on Twitter at Crystal Seas, 2 S's at the end, 118. After the break, was Hillary Clinton right to argue, on our podcast, that Europe must curb immigration to stop right-wing populists? Now, in an interview with The Guardian's Patrick Winter, broadcast on Friday's Today in Focus, Hillary Clinton suggested that Europe needed to get a handle on immigration. The Guardian's Nesrin Malik says the former US Secretary of State is completely wrong.
So I was on Twitter, as every journalist, I think, is, every good journalist, at least, on a Thursday night, and saw the comments and was incredibly angry, even though I thought I'd become inured to Clinton making these sorts of statements. Yeah, it made me incredibly upset. The fundamental error at the heart of this thinking is in accepting the populist narrative that immigration does roil the body politic, as she said in her statements. That is the result of populist agitation rather than the cause of it. The problem isn't immigrants, it's the fear of immigrants. And Clinton does not get that, or she doesn't want to get that. So this view that Hillary Clinton has is, at best, a sort of relaxed indifference to the plight of immigrants. At worst, it is a full-throated agreement with populists and right-wingers because it does subscribe to the notion that immigration is a bad thing and therefore we shouldn't really advocate for it. Clinton's comments on immigration betray a real disconnect, actually, which is a feature of populist politics, which is to always claim that immigration is very high. So in her own country, in America, Trump has deported fewer people than Barack Obama. In Europe, immigration has decreased over the past 2 years because of harsher policies. But the line continues to be the same, which is it's too high, it's creating all these problems. So populists have just been better at building a case against immigration. It is in the media. It is the first thing that a populist politician will mention in debates, on the radio, in interviews. They have been making a case for a very long time, actually. And what the centre has failed to do, because they're afraid that this whole immigration thing might backfire, they've either been quiet or tried to mimic the tactics of the right or populist immigration. But what really they need to do is make a positive case for it. Just spell out the figures, spell out the numbers, show people what the benefit is for the rest of the country, show people the plight of refugees and asylum seekers, and leave it up to the country to decide between those two sets of facts. There's two things at stake here. One is an issue of morality and of compassion. Just hundreds of thousands of lives are at stake. The second thing that is at stake is sort of the political culture of the centre and the left. Once these things become mainstreamed, they are gateways for other things, to harsher, more draconian attitudes towards equality and kindness to fellow man. I hope Clinton runs in 2020. She's been incredibly helpful and illustrative since she lost the election, in that she's really showing us the bankruptcy and the sort of sterility of this sort of centrist politics. I was one of those people when Clinton ran who was very afraid of false equivalence between her and Trump, and tried to see the sort of positive aspects of a non-Trump presidency. But two things can be true at the same time. The fact that Trump is worse than Clinton does not mean that Clinton is not the worst of the establishment center. And I hope she continues to run and speak and give interviews until every last person sees that.
You can listen to Hillary Clinton's argument on Friday's episode of Today in Focus and read Patrick's interview at theguardian.com. If you're enjoying our podcast, please do subscribe. My thanks to David Stevens, Sam Wollaston and Nesrin Malik. Today's episode was produced by India Rackerson, Josh Kelly and David Waters. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executives were Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.